This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, so I'm wearing my underwear and all my clothes, and but I'm in bed. And you remember the old sitcoms when they couldn't show couples in bed?
I do.
So they had the show that couples always had like two little beds with a nightstand between them. And that was like how couples slept in old sitcoms and TV shows.
Yeah.
That's how me and Mark Kenyon are right now. We're in a hotel room and we're in little beds, laying in little beds. And Doug Duren and the Eagle are in little chairs facing us.
But we're in chairs.
Mark Kenyon. Now, you like I think you've even said this before, that you use the term like you're a whitetail guy.
Yeah, true.
Can you, like, I understand what it means. I want you to explain for people what it means to be a whitetail guy. Because, like, I always say that I'm a big game generalist,
yeah,
which isn't really a category. You know, no one types in big game generalists into search engines.
The truth about big game generalists.
The truth about big game generalists. But what is a
how do your small game exploits fit into being a big game generalist?
Well, I'm a hunting generalist, but in terms of talking about big game, yeah, in terms of big game, I'm a big game generalist, but I'm a hunting generalist with an emphasis on big game generalistness. But what is a whitetail guy, Mark?
For me, a whitetail guy means that's what I grew up on. So that was almost all I hunted growing up was whitetails. And now it still comprises probably 90% of my hunting and then most of my year otherwise. I mean, I'm doing whitetail-related stuff almost the entire year from January through December, whether it's hunting or scouting or preparing spots or all sorts of different things. So when I say I'm a whitetail guy, I mean, that is like my number one passion. It's also how I make my living. And then I have, you know, as my ability to travel and do different things has grown, you know, I've been dabbling in new things, which I've really come to enjoy. I've been able to go hunting elk now for the last 4 years, you know, learned how to turkey hunt like 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. So I love doing that now. And you know, I putzed around with small game when I was a kid too, but whitetails were what got me with a meat hook in the heart, I'd say.
Yeah. Is your foot touching the ground? That's interesting because I think that when TV evolved to allow couples to be in bed, in one bed,
yeah.
I think one of the people in the couple had to have a foot on the floor.
There were crazy rules, yeah.
Yeah, I think that once they could have the same bed, the foot had to be on the floor. So this must
be. So those were like FCC rules?
Yeah, I think that Mark's fixing to come over into my bed,
you know,
with that foot on the floor.
It's been a really good trip, Steve. but I got to tell you, what's funny is my one of my wife's biggest pet peeves about visiting my family is that as soon as I started dating Kylie, my parents in my bedroom where I grew up, they took out my regular full-size bed and replaced it with two little
teeny
singles.
Beds in case so now, she slept over.
Yeah, so now even we're still married and we sleep in separate beds in there.
No way, really?
Like a regular Ozzy and Harriet.
Huh? She's like, why do we still do this?
But your parents did it for that reason?
Cause they explained that it was because the old bed was bad, and they had company coming over to spend a weekend, and they happened to know someone who had these almost new beds. And
yeah, they didn't want their son defiling the family home.
Yeah, that might be what's actually happening.
How comfortable are you? Like, how comfortable are you saying when you say you make your living doing it? Like spell off of what that means.
Yeah,
because I think a lot of most dudes in the world, if you said, hey, do you want to make your living hunting? Not most dudes in the world. Most dudes who might be inclined to be listening to this right now would be like, sure.
Yeah.
So what does it look like? What does it mean
to be like a
professional whitetail guy?
So what that means for me, it's not actually the hunting that makes my living necessarily. It's content that I create based on those experiences. So I run wiredhunt.com, which is a deer hunting website, and the Wired Hunt podcast, which is a deer hunting podcast. So I make probably 75% of my income from advertising and things related to that. And then I write for most of the big deer hunting magazines. I've written for Outdoor Life, Field and Stream, etc. So do some freelance writing. And then a little bit of like merchandise sales and some digital ebooks and kind of things like that. But basically content related to whitetail hunting. And my core audience and really where I started was like that. You know, the tagline of Wired Hunt was deer hunting for the next generation. So it's been really focused on that really, really serious whitetail guy that's thinking whitetails all year round. And, you know, producing content around that lifestyle.
What, that's something, I think that Doug, you said something to Doug, and then Doug said it to me. So I want to circle back around and ask you about it. Where there's like a seasonality to hunting, okay? And in the business of hunting, so when I say the business of hunting, I mean that's like content, right? There's like stuff that people watch for enjoyment, stuff that people watch and read in order to learn, equipment that people purchase. Just like activity around hunting is like strongly seasonal, where after Labor Day, people start like there's like a creeping interest in hunting, and then it lingers past hunting season, kind of through the holidays, as people are still thinking about, like, it's still fresh in their head, like stuff they wanted to get, stuff they wanted to do. They're still excited about it. They're kind of sharing memories about their fall. And then it sort of peters off and goes away. And Doug was recapping a conversation he had with you. And you were saying that it's kind of like in the whitetail world, it's kind of almost not that way anymore.
Mm. I'd agree with that, yeah.
Like what? Like why?
Because there's always something to be doing. So, I mean, okay, let's just start at the beginning of the year. In January and February, it's postseason scouting. So you can scout and see sign and so many different things a lot better during that time frame. It's tracks in the snow. As the snow starts to melt in early March, or depending where you're at, then you can really see rut-related signs, so rubs and scrapes and stuff left over from the year before. So there's a lot of that going on January through March. And then, you know, late February through March, that is shed hunting, and that's huge in the whitetail community these days. So, I mean, tons of interest related to shed hunting. And then once you get later into the spring, then everyone's worked on their habitat projects. So then all April, May, June, you're talking food plots or timber stand improvements or creating bedding cover or whatever it might be. And then you get into summer, and then everybody's talking about hanging my tree stands, getting out your trail cameras to see what kind of bucks are in the area, scouting bean fields, getting all your final prep, archery practice, rifle practice, whatever it is you're doing all the way. And then all of a sudden September and you're hunting again in some states, October 1st and others, and it's spread out. But yeah, I mean, every single day of my year, something whitetail related is going on. Except for the last like seven.
Yeah. Cause you've been hunting caribou.
Been hunting caribou.
When you say you're going out in January to check tracks, what exactly are you doing?
So, I mean, that kind of situation, like you might be walking the edges of a cut cornfield and see if you can cut a big track. And if you cut a big track, you might know, okay, there's a mature buck potential here. And if the season's done, that's a great opportunity to follow that track back and determine where that buck's bedding. And, you know, no risk there. If I bump him, no big deal.
Yeah.
But you can learn.
And then you know he lived, and the strong likelihood he's going to be alive next hunting season.
Yeah. And these mature bucks, at least in the places where I hunt, you know, like Michigan or other heavily pressured states, so there's a lot of hunters. These bucks, they bed places for a reason. Like, nothing's happening willy-nilly. If a mature buck is bedded in an area, it's because he knows he's got, you know, safety. He's not got a lot of humans going in there. He's got some way to get out of there quickly. He can observe or smell what's happening throughout the day. So when you find those kinds of areas, not only is that mature buck that's alive right now probably going to continue to use that, but that's probably going to be used in the future by future bucks. So if that buck, if you kill that deer, someone else is going to come in there and pick it up. So if you can identify those buck bedding areas, you're in a good situation moving forward.
So you spend a lot of time backtracking deer.
Sometimes, yeah.
When you look for a big track, like what is the? I mean, everybody likes to, you know, everybody likes to think they know a big track. Okay, where you got that the dew claws are splayed out, like the animal gets to a certain weight. Like, talk through some of that stuff, some of the fallacies and truths about like what does a big old buck track look like.
I can't say I'm an expert on this, but what I always look for is a four-finger track. So something that wide across there. If you've got, and it doesn't look like it's a running track, if it's a walking track.
A walking four-finger wide track. Now, consider that my hands are extremely powerful.
That It's a big hand.
Yeah.
So, it's very subjective. I know that.
Yeah.
It's very subjective.
But that's a walking track 4 fingers wide.
That's big.
On a grown male.
Yeah. And that's, have you heard that, Doug? That's something I've been told a lot.
Yeah. And the key is the walking track also, because any deer or any buck's track looks big if it's a running or moving track. So I agree with that. I mean, imagine a 4-finger track for me and it's one of my cattle got out, you know.
Have we ever done a handoff? Like where you take your hands and press them together to see who's the most powerful?
Yeah, that'd be an interesting one.
Yeah.
I do want to point out that I did have you on the handoff length at least.
Yeah, but when you factor in height.
Like my actual
proportion.
You are right.
No, I've told this story before. My old man met John Wayne, and John Wayne commented on my old man's hand.
That's something to be proud of.
Yes.
What was the comment?
I've never shook a hand bigger than mine. And my old man should have said, "And you never fought in the war," and I did. He sat it out. He sat it out. His name was not John Wayne. His name is Marion.
Yeah.
And he sat the war out.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know if my dad rubbed his nose in it. The director, John Ford, rubbed John Wayne's nose in that. Because Ford was in the service. And did propaganda films and put his life at tremendous risk many times. Then later on went on to make all these great westerns with John Wayne. And Ford would embarrass and ridicule Wayne about his lack of service.
Interesting. Your knowledge about films has surprised me in this.
Dude, I like movies a lot, man.
I did not realize you had that catalog in the mind there. It's interesting.
Big buck tracks. Does a big, huge buck track... As he gets older, does it round off on the tip?
I think it varies. It's very individual. I think you see, this isn't something I've gone as far to do, but I know some guys, and I probably should try to do this more so, they will actually go about trying to identify individual bucks by their tracks. And so there will
be some
bucks.
That's what I'm leading toward. So if you want to jump into that, jump into that.
Yeah, so I haven't done this yet, but there are some guys I know that can look at certain tracks. They say they can. I can't verify that, but they tell me they can. Identify like a little chink in it or a rounded edge on one side or something.
I would believe a chink.
Yeah, something like that. And then, so here's something some people do to make this a little bit easier. Make track catchers. So let's say you have got a food source and maybe there's a handful of trails that lead into that food source. Let's just say it's a cornfield. And there's a handful of trails leading to that cornfield. And you want to know, how is buck X coming into this area? What some guys will do is they will go in there and they will rake out.
Back up. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean that you're out with your knockers and you see a big old buck standing in a field and you're like, and you're wondering like, what route is he using to get here? Like, how can I head him off? Because once he's in it, I'm not going to.
Correct.
So in that case, then you're curious, like, you know, back in the woods, what is he doing before he arrives here?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so there's several ways to determine that. One, you could observe. If you can find an observation stand or something where you can watch that and see into the timber. Number two, you could use trail cameras. So actually put a camera on trails and stuff and monitor that way. Or a third way is making these track catchers where you essentially will clear out an area on that trail really clean and flat, without leaves, and make it a nice, even dirt area, and then come back in the next day and see which one of those trails has that big buck track. Or, you know, maybe you saw the buck come off trail X, and you know to go check that track catcher because you know he walked through there.
Yeah.
And then you can see that print cleanly pressed in there and say, okay, he came through here. This is what his track looks like. Take a picture of it or something. And in the future, you've got one more tool in your chest that you can use to try to pattern that deer.
Are you familiar with... not familiar with, but lion hunters in the desert, like guys that are hunting lions in the absence of snow,
mm-hmm.
will carry around little whisk brooms, sometimes full-on brooms, to dust out, just to wipe it clean on any kind of little crossing spots or like dry creek beds, just to try to see.
Exact same concept.
Yeah.
We used to do that as elk hunting guides. Like certain bigger trails that we walked a lot, and you'd get to certain sections that were just like soft and sandy, or you knew that it was some sort of like just a crossing or whatnot. It would often have elk tracks, and so we would clean them out, and that way next time you walk through, you'd be like, oh, somebody was here in the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
You know, there's elk in the area.
When fur trapping, in fur trapping, we trap muskrat and mink and raccoon and beaver and stuff. You pay a lot of attention to undercut banks. Like a lot of animals like to do to move along streams, they'll always use undercut banks because it gives you overhead protection.
Makes sense.
You know, you're not like if you're a little mink working, you're just not exposed to avian predators and whatever else. And there's a lot of food under there because all the other shit that's trying not to get eaten is also living under the undercut bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go along my hip boots. And anytime you had an undercut bank where there's a little bit of sand or mud on the bottom, you just, without even thinking about it, kick water up in there to slick it. So the next time you came by, you'd see, you know, you'd like slick it out to see if there's a mink working it or whatever. So yeah, it's like a technique that probably it's probably been invented many times.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it makes it a simple but effective,
logical way to do it. Like the first time someone did it and showed it to me, I was like, oh, I've been like walking this trail for 3 years, you know, and how come I didn't think about that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's like the January kind of activity. Now, shed hunting.
Yeah.
Are dudes hunting sheds because they're trying to learn what kind of bucks are about, or are they just hunting sheds because they want to find them because they like to have them? I think it's the latter.
I think it's a combination of both. At least, well, for me, it's both, and most of the guys I hang out with, it's both. I mean, antlers are cool. I love having an antler in my hand and getting a look at it and turn it around. And
give them to people, put them in your house, whatever.
I usually don't give them to people.
You're stingy with them.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
They're few and far between in Michigan.
Doug's loose with them, skulls and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah?
He's an older guy.
See, yeah, you've...
He's thinking about the end.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, it is funny that you say that, though, because when you, Mark was saying deer hunting, or what was it, for the next generation?
Yeah, deer hunting for the next generation.
That was one of the conversations that we had up there on the mountain, was that I'm twice his age.
Yeah.
And I am. It's a bittersweet... That's a bittersweet thing, though, to realize, my God, you're the old guy, you know?
They've become less and less important to me.
Like, I think that happens.
I used to very much just, like, hoard them, never wanted to give them away, and then eventually I was just like, really? Why?
Yeah.
Why are these important to me?
I think there's, like, a threshold, maybe. Like, I feel like I'm just starting to get to that point where I haven't, like, at first it was so, like, I had 2, and then 10, and then 12, and like it's such a special thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get to a certain number, it's easier to part with them.
But if it's on your property, it's nice to know.
Yeah.
I mean, I found both sides on a couple of different occasions, and
that's,
it's like,
super cool.
I want to kill this deer.
Yeah.
Or if I kill this deer, it's going to be cool to have his sheds.
Yeah, but this is the, okay, all right. So to recap, like, now I got myself all messed up. I get it, but I want to get back to the primary question.
Yes.
So with all the trail cameras and watching and looking and scouting and all that kind of shit, you're telling me now and then you'll find a shed antler. Now, I want to back up for the real neophytes here. Deer, I'm going way backing up. Deer lose their antlers every year. Some people don't really realize this.
They sure do.
A deer drops his antler and regenerates it every year. So when people talk about horns and antlers, and sometimes people will say, like, oh, that deer's horns, and yeah, okay, that's fine, but it's not a horn, it's an antler. A horn, an animal keeps his whole life. Mountain goats, bighorn sheep, all the crazy African animals, they got horns, and you retain your horns, with one exception: the pronghorn, the American pronghorn or antelope, is the only horned animal that sheds its horn and grows it new every year. And horns are like basically made out of hair. Antlers are like bone. So when we say a shed, we mean like the annual shed. And a buck, with some exceptions, but generally a buck every year is going to grow bigger and bigger antlers. If he's fortunate enough to live so long and hits what age, Mark?
6, 7, 8, older than that, they start to go
back downhill.
Yeah.
But
typically,
yeah, but one in a thousand bucks lives that old.
Yeah,
they just don't live that long. Too much shit happens to them. So you're telling me that you have, in all the thinking and scouting and looking and trail camming that you're up to, that you'll now and then find a shed antler and be like, I didn't know that this buck existed.
Well, it depends. If it's a property that you hunt, that I've been doing all those things, Yeah, that still happens sometimes.
Really? So he lived this whole damn year,
but
and then shed his antler and evaded your attention.
Lots of times, though, these deer have different ranges. So, like the bucks that I'm seeing in the summer and the hunting season, but those might be very different than a buck that shows up in March and sheds his antler. For example, there's a deer I've been hunting and watching for a couple of years now that he shows up on this property like the first week of September, right when the velvet comes off. He relocates to that fall range.
No, define property. What do you mean? Like you give it an acreage, like what you're talking about.
So there's a property in Mid-Michigan that I hunt that is a 90-acre farm that I have permission to hunt on.
So small, relatively small, like small farm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all relative, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
But I mean, like in Michigan, like when I lived in Michigan and we were hunting, we hunted a lot of like working family farms that were big enough to support, you know, a family. There was a lot of farms in the range of 300 to 400 acres in the area I grew up.
Man, by us, at least everything's getting fractured. Smaller and smaller and smaller properties. Yeah. I mean, it's all 40s and 80s these days almost is what I see. So I feel somewhat fortunate to have 90 acres to hunt on there. It gives me enough to work with. Half of it's open field, so you can't do much with that. But then the other half has some cover and stuff.
Oh, dude,
so.
I'm not dogging on having 90 acres. That's fantastic. I'm just trying to clarify for people who don't like deal in acreages in their head we're talking about.
Were you pointing that out a couple days ago? That's so funny to hear me talk about properties when hunting out west. That's something you guys don't think about at all. But yeah, I think that's everyone that I hunt with and around. That's how you work. I've got permission on two properties, or I've got this property or that property that you can hunt. And you have to cherish those because they're fleeting. Getting permission, you can lose it quick. You can get kicked off a property like we joked about.
Yeah. They sell it out from under you or some little cousin.
Have them pay.
Yeah, and that happens.
Yep. And cousins are the bane of hunters, man. Because every dude that owns property, it's inevitable they got some damn cousin who eventually is going to come around wanting to tap into his birthright and boot you off the property. But you got a 90-acre property, and then you have freedom to roam there. But in all the surrounding properties, you might not be able to. Whatever happens there is someone else's business.
Yeah, yeah. I try to get permission on as many places as I can, you know, to increase your flexibility and your options and stuff. So in some places, I have permission on multiple properties. Some places, just a tiny little piece here or there. But in this case, yeah, I've got permission on a 90, surrounded by other landowners.
And there's a buck of interest.
Buck of interest. And yeah, he shows up in September. He hangs out till January, and then he disappears.
But I don't understand what you mean. Like, shows up from where? Like, how far away could it possibly be? Not a mile or two?
I've heard and seen examples of a mile or two. Yeah, it could be just on the other side of your 640-acre block. So I know, like, in some cases, like in this case, a sort of distant neighbor that I keep in communication with has gotten summer trail cameras of this buck, but I've never seen him or gotten pictures in the summer. But then he sees him almost never during the fall. I see him all the time during the fall.
Do you think he's moving there because of something going on with agricultural timing, or do you think it has something to do with him prepping, coming in because he's fixing to mate some does?
I can't necessarily put my finger on it because, you know, the crops are rotating every year. So it's not like he's only going over there on years when it's a soybean year, and then he comes over on mine when it's a soybean year on the property I can hunt there. So it's not necessarily related to that. You know, a lot of times bucks will prefer to summer in areas with more mature cover and stuff, because when they've got those big velvet antlers, they're not necessarily wanting to get in the thick, nasty stuff that they would later in the fall. So lots of times you're going to see mature bucks in the summer and like habitat like where I'm at. They might bed and hang out in areas of big mature timber stands that are close to like a soybean field or something, good summer nutrition. Then once you get into September, testosterone's rising, velvet comes off, they start relocating to these fall ranges where, number one, there's better fall cover, because once those leaves come down, they require different cover. And then number two, they want to go where there's going to be more does, because of course that time period's coming up, the rut. But they want to establish their own space from other bucks, and they need space.
How old's this deer that you're looking at?
This buck should be 5.5 this year.
Oh yeah.
Which in Michigan doesn't happen.
Oh yeah, yeah, no doubt. I have found that the older the deer gets, the older the buck gets, the less he moves.
A tighter core range, yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen and heard the same.
What do you feel is a deer's core range? Like how much, I should say what you feel, because it's known now, because of tracking data, it's like, it's not like intuition anymore. Like how much space does a whitetail deer use?
So I am going to get the specific numbers wrong here, but there's a home range and a core range are kind of the terminology that's thrown around. The home range is something like where that buck spends about 75%. No, let me take that back. Yeah, about 75% of his movements are going to be within that home range. And that can be like 300 to 1,000 acres, something like that, like a relatively large area.
Where he might at some point in time turn up.
Yeah. But then there's that core range where he's spending the very most, like that's the most concentrated amount of his movement. And that can be 40, 60, 80 acres. So much tighter area where he's bedded most of the time, where he's going to be feeding most of the time. But then there are these forays, like it's well proven, especially during the rut, that bucks and even does will take these extended forays randomly, a mile, two out of their core range, seemingly at random, possibly following a doe or different things like that, and then they'll return back to that core, a week later or something.
I think it's always kind of add something. It's interesting to add, to sort of compare it to what the Arizona guys see with their whitetails, because it's so much more open, right? And they get to sort of experience what you're talking about through their binoculars at 2 miles away.
Right.
And, we talked to some guys that kill bucks that they've seen like sleeping underneath the same cactus or same oak tree, dozens of days, and just they don't move sometimes. Bucks just live in one little bitty canyon, and sleep under the same tree.
There's a story we heard about a desert whitetail. You might remember the details, Yanni. Someone in our circle of associates had found a desert whitetail or a coos deer under a tree. And it was a big, nice buck, and it wasn't seasoned. And it had distinctive antlers. And then they looked for it and looked for it and looked for it over the next several years. Is this right?
I think.
Could never find it. And then one day, they found it again, laying under the tree. Just was there, like maybe it was just in that little pocket the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but what they talk about, these guys that hunt coos deer a lot, because you're looking at it, it's like in the Midwest, all whitetail activity is like hidden from view, and you have to do all this stuff. But like out there where it's open, yeah, you can get back and just observe the whole thing. What they talk about is glassing up a big buck, finding his, like identifying his little zone, and then just finding a little sniper's perch somewhere like in the vicinity of his zone, and then you just lay there for a couple days waiting for him to do his
thing,
and you're just like peeking in on it, which isn't the luxury you have in flat timbered brushy country.
Yeah. I will point out though, to your point, Yana, sort of that those core and home ranges and the amount of movement, even a whitetail in the Midwest or Northeast, that is very habitat dependent too. Mm. So, if you're in an area where they have to travel much farther distances to get between decent food and good security cover, it can be much larger. But I think in an area where it's evenly dispersed cover, food, water, et cetera, I think those numbers tend to be in that range.
So the buck you're talking about, the buck that got to be 5.5 years old, how did he get to be 5.5 years old? Like, how has he avoided getting shot 4 times?
So,
when just every buck gets shot.
Yeah.
Or not every buck. Yeah, every buck eventually gets hit by a car, killed by coyotes, shot by a gun, or just whatever other accidents befall him, tangled up in a woven wire fence. Like, I've seen it quite a number of times over the years. Like, just stuff happens to him.
Yeah. So, I think a lot of it's luck, right? I mean, because all those things you listed up, fences, cars, coyotes, none of that stuff has happened yet. But outside of luck, I think two things. Number one, he has a very tight core range. Like I've never had a buck that I've hunted and observed that is so habitual in a small area that he uses. Like during the hunting season, because of how this property lays out, there's a big hill up towards the front of it that I can sit on and I can look down over. I can actually see a decent ways into this area, some fields, and you can actually see into this brushy, like multiflora rose type stuff.
I know that stuff. Yeah.
Great cover and tall grass, but from high I can see down into it.
You guys, you guys ever chase cottontails down that multiflora rose?
No, because that's on a neighboring property.
Oh, I got you.
But I can see it. And that buck, during the hunting season, is there almost every day. I mean, he stays in a very small area. So I know he's possibly going to come feed on the property I can hunt. He's going to bed just over the edge into this thick stuff. And then if I hunt, one or two stands where I can see that area, I can almost almost guarantee I'm going to see him.
Are dudes hunting that property too?
Not often. So that's the thing that we've got going, is that there's a hunter there that doesn't go in very often. So he has kind of a sanctuary there on that property most of the year. And then on the property I can hunt, I'm very, very careful about how I hunt it and when I hunt it. So he's got kind of a two-property section there that's almost hunting pressure-free that he can roam around in. So he's got that going for him.
Are you friendly with the other guy?
Yes.
Is he aware of this buck also?
Yes. Now, he doesn't know. We haven't talked about it to the degree I'm obsessed with this buck.
Yeah, like he might be aware, like, oh, I heard there's a big buck back there. That's what a lot of people think of it, but they don't think of it like, what is it actually up to?
Yeah, yeah. So we've like had drinks together, and I mentioned, oh, there's this nice buck that I see every once in a while. And
so he's on board with the idea of let's let deer get bigger and stuff.
Yes, yeah. Ish. Yes. I think he's not quite as serious about it as I am, but uh-huh. We've talked about it in the past, and it sounds like he's not interested in shooting, you know, like year-and-a-half-old bucks and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple different people. I've tried to meet everyone I can in the area, and most of them want to see, you know, bucks get a little bit of age on them. So that's a good thing in the general area.
Yep.
There's a handful of properties where they don't do that, a couple of properties where they do. But then the second or the third thing, I guess, that has allowed this buck to get to that point, and maybe I'm going to take too much credit for myself, but I've chosen not to kill him. So the very first year I saw him the night before opening day of bow season in Michigan, and he was a nice 3.5-year-old buck. It was the best looking buck I had seen on the property that year. And at that point I was interested in shooting a 3.5-year-old deer in Michigan, because that's still hard to find too. So he was a buck that I would shoot, but opening night came and a different buck came and I killed that deer. And so I decided I'm not going to kill this other deer now, because I've already taken one off this property. So I was just going to shoot does the rest of the season. So he got a free pass the rest of that year. I had him within bow range later in the season and chose not to shoot him.
Hmm.
Last year, he'd be a 4-year-old. And again, I was seeing him a lot, had learned a lot about him from the past year. So I definitely wanted to shoot him last year. I saw him with my own eyes 27 times during the season last year. Had him, yeah, crazy, right?
Yeah.
Had a shot at him at 40 yards one evening, but it was like right at last light. And I just didn't feel comfortable taking a shot in those conditions.
Oh, but you would have shot him last year.
I would have shot him last year.
How many inches of horn of antler does he have?
So last year he probably would have been like 100 and mid 130 eight pointer.
As a four year old.
Huh. Which is a really good Michigan buck.
Yeah. Wow.
I had all these encounters earlier in the season. Gun season comes. I was like, I couldn't pull it off. He's probably going to get killed during gun season. You know, I made, you know, made peace with that reality. Like, I had an awesome experience with this deer. He's probably gone. But lo and behold, December shows up. He's still alive. And something like clicked in my mind in like early December when I realized he'd made it through all of October. He'd made it through all of November in the rut and gun season. And I kind of realized, wow, this deer could actually make it another year. And I'd already killed two bucks. I'd already killed two bucks last year and several does, and I realized I don't need to fill another tag. I don't need to kill this buck. He probably could make it to next year. And I've just come, like, it's been a very unique thing to be able to watch a deer over 2 years. So I've become, you know, so invested in, like, this experience and this interaction with this deer that I kind of got to the point where I was like, you know what, I'd like to see if he'll be around next year.
Yeah, but as a writer, you almost can't kill the sumbitch. At this point, you got to be like, the story would be, and there he was, and I had this chance. You ever see the movie The Golden Seal?
No.
There he was. I had a chance. And then just like, you ever see Deer Hunter?
No.
What?
Oh, my goodness.
No, I know. I should have seen
it. He's only 29 years or 30 years old.
Yeah, oh, shit. 30. I saw The Deer Hunter 5 times by the time I was 30 years old. It's a Vietnam movie. You don't know, like.
I've heard of it. I just haven't seen it yet.
It's Boys from Pennsylvania. Grow up in the mining world. Every year they hunt, you know, they go up and hunt the mountains every year. And they go off to Vietnam. One of them's in the Green Berets. They wind up in a prison camp. Two of them wind up in the prison camp together. The VC use them to make bets on Russian roulette. They get deeply damaged. Come home. Robert De Niro goes up back hunting with his friends. For some weird reason, a red stag comes out. In movies, they always screw, you know, you always find in American movies, They always got red stags in them. Like they make that mistake in Last of the Mohicans.
You know who made the movie definitely is not a wildlife.
Yeah. So a stag comes out, but De Niro doesn't shoot it. Instead, he starts, you know, he's like, it's over, and doesn't shoot it. The golden seal is a very valuable seal.
And when you say seal, are we talking a what kind of seal?
Seal, I don't know.
Like an animal?
Ring seal. I can't remember. So it was when I was a kid.
So it's an animal.
Dude finally gets a crack at it. Yeah, dude finally gets a crack at it and decides not to take the shot.
Okay.
He's like, no, I can't do it. So I think now this buck, when you get the chance, you got to be like, let him walk off into the sunset, man. Because don't you think you know him too well now to shoot him?
Well, I mean, it's definitely getting that. I've gotten to
would
the point
where.
Would
you shoot your dog?
No, I wouldn't shoot my dog. I would shoot. What, like, I would shoot this deer.
How is this deer, after all of these years of interactions, how are you going to then go jab an arrow into him?
I know. It's a really weird paradox.
Dude.
Because you're 100% right. And I
picture
have to
the movie.
That.
And in the end, he's like, bam.
Look at his face. Look at his face. He's going to pull back and shoot that deer.
What happened to your socks, Doug?
I'm wearing my comfy shoes without socks.
Dude, post hunt, let him air out.
Airing him toes out, huh?
So now I'm interested in this buck. And
see Doug's gonna get name permission. Yeah.
Where exactly is this? Yeah.
You know? All my friends threaten to do that too.
Yeah. No. So he continues to be an eight, or is he starting to get some junk? Or
so up to this point, he's
really.
So I haven't.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I'm trying to get in some heavy shit here, right? About him finally taking.
I'm visualizing the deer.
Like, does he got any stickers?
Well,
so he is a tight and tall 8-pointer. He has been that for the last 2 years. He's just gotten heavier every year.
Huh.
But I don't know what he looks like this year because I haven't seen.
Well, you haven't seen him. Oh, because he's on the he's on the mystery.
He's in his mystery place.
Over.
So I saw.
So how
him.
Do you know he's going to show up? You don't.
I don't. So right about now is when he usually shows up.
Oh, so there's still a lot of this is not a done deal yet.
Oh no, not a done deal.
But he checked back. But you know, in December
he made it through the hunting season. Yeah. He made it all the way through March. I saw him in March, still
so
carrying his antlers.
So you don't know.
I don't know. He's
not walking under your tree stand every night right now.
Not yet, but well, starting right about now, he usually starts to. So
have you found his sheds?
Never found a shed.
What have you named
scoured.
Him? What's his name? Don't tell me he doesn't have a name.
He has a name. He has a name. That's what those whitetail guys do.
Oh.
No, you saw me name a caribou the other
night. Yeah, you named him Snow Angel. That's right. So I won't be ashamed at all.
I named him Snow King, Snow Angel,
someone
Snow
called
White,
Snowflake.
Snowflake. He picked up a lot of names.
He
all sort of based off a snow theme.
He did.
What is his name? You don't want to tell me?
I will tell you. And I know it does sound ridiculous to some people from an outside perspective.
Sound ridiculous.
But
no, it's an efficiency thing.
It is.
It's an efficiency. That's all it is.
Oh, yeah, because we often name stuff El Seis, El Ocho, El Siete, whatever.
Fabio.
We do it with a hint of
Sarcasm. But I think everyone at this point does with a hint of sarcasm. Almost everyone does with a hint of sarcasm because there's some outlandish names out there.
Yeah. But, I mean, what am I going to do for 3 years? Oh, you know that 1 8-pointer that I've seen 27 times?
Oh, exactly.
Well, I did try to dub a caribou we were looking at, that one caribou way over there.
Yes, you did.
But it just was cumbersome.
That
and so
that didn't stick.
We settled on Snow Angel.
So this buck I refer to as Holyfield because he's got a chunk missing out of his ear. So it was a natural fit. And yeah. Hopefully he'll be there when I get back home.
Dude, I'm going to think so much less of you if you jab an arrow into this deer after all of this time together.
But on balance, I'd be really disappointed if you didn't if you get the opportunity.
Well, here's another way of looking at it. He's walking dead.
What do you mean? Like he's going to get killed.
Like yeah, he's just like he's at the end of his time on Earth.
It's gonna
five
happen.
And a half.
By someone or something, yes.
Yeah.
It was interesting, though. Last year, so I have a podcast, so I talk about all these things with my own audience a lot. And so the story of Holyfield has become like this long-running thing that all these people are following. And so last year when I decided, you know, I don't want to shoot him this year. And I had a really lengthy conversation, all you know, going through my thought process and why I decided I didn't want to do that. There was an incredibly passionate response from a lot of people. A lot of people were like, I totally get it. And then a lot of people, I can't believe you're not going to shoot it. You're letting us down. Like, kill that damn buck.
What?
We want the story. Like, someone else is going
to
kill
it. They wanted a resolution.
Yeah, they want a resolution to the story.
But you said it was pretty equal, though. You had other people that were like...
Yeah, oh, I'd say it was 90%, like, totally get what you're saying. But then there was a very loud and passionate 10% that wants that deer dead.
Just to see.
Just, yeah, like you said, resolution.
They to have their story wrapped up.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of people that feel like they're living vicariously through this experience, like, and because it's been such a consistent thing we talked about. And some people are probably just so sick and tired of me talking about it. They just want to move on to something new.
You know what's refreshing about you, what I like about you, one of the things, is that the there's sort of these national standards in big bucks, right, where people sort of, like, what is an acceptable big giant buck is set by, like, very specific regions that just for a multitude of reasons are able to produce genuine big, huge, giant bucks, right? Like, big, huge, giant bucks used to, like, for a while, it was like Alberta, right? That's where big bucks came from. And then it wound up being that certain places in Illinois and Iowa started, like, cranking out big bucks. And they would set sort of the national standard of what's a big buck. So if you're going to put a buck on, like, the cover of a magazine, bucks on the covers of magazines are oftentimes not even real bucks.
Yeah.
There are magazines in existence who have an editorial stance against the captive servant industry. So they have an editorial stance against pen-raised deer and canned hunts. Yet, they adorn their own covers with pen-raised bucks.
Yeah.
And it creates the same way that you hear, and I'm attuned to this now that I have a daughter, the same way that you hear that there's a standard of beauty put forth by the fashion industry and by the media that is unachievable by most women who don't have the time and money to devote to their appearance, where we've created, like, a beauty standard. I mean, you know, I'm aware of this. This doesn't keep me up at night, but it's the thing people talk about. The same thing happens with bucks, right? But you have, like... You, for whatever reason, don't feel that you're able to look and be like, well, what is, like, good for the area? Like, what is a big buck kind of for a normal guy hunting normal kind of little 90-acre parcels of land in a heavily hunted area and celebrate those deer without feeling that you need to go down and you go down to Texas to a high fence place to enter into the real whitetail guy world?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think that one of the one thing that has come out of the deer hunting media world has been just the setting of unrealistic expectations for people. Because if you watch TV, all you see are these gigantic bucks being killed so easily, it seems, every single time you watch a show. But they're in Iowa or Illinois or Kansas, and they're hunting
tightly managed 1,000-acre chunks of ground.
It's just something that 95% of people can't relate to. But then you get people, even especially maybe newer hunters, that watch that stuff. That's their only way of establishing a context for what is good or what I'm supposed to do. So then they start hunting and they're thinking, why can't I shoot a buck like that? And they get disappointed and frustrated. They hang it up.
And then they act like apologetic about their deer all the time, which is that's, like, the really painful part to me, is when people, like, send you pictures like, yeah, it's just a little one, you know. But I'm like, dude, don't be, like, so disrespectful to the animals, man.
Yeah.
You know?
I think any animal you kill, I mean, should be celebrated and respected. And that is awesome. I think everybody needs to set their own goals for what experience they want. So for me, you know, I like to target mature bucks because I want a certain experience out of that hunting season. If I were to shoot the first deer I saw, my hunting season would be done.
It'd be an evening event.
So out of my hunting experience, I of course want meat. I also want a lengthy experience. I want to be out there for a long period of time. I want to be learning and observing and interacting with these animals. I want a challenge. You know, hunting mature buck allows that whole thing to happen. And I enjoy that chess match. I enjoy whether it be a situation like this where I hunt one single property and learn a specific buck. Like, that is a really interesting, unique way to engage with, like, with an animal. And then I also enjoy the challenge of, like, going to a brand new place. I don't know anything there. And I just enjoy the challenge of trying to learn that property and learn what's happening here. How can I interact with it? How can I set up and kill a deer here? There's something really cool about all those different things.
But this buck you've been watching for these 3 years, is that right? For 3 years?
Yeah.
You've been aware of him for 3 years? This buck that you've been watching for 3 years and you know so intimately, and he's kind of in the autumn of his life, whether you get him or not, he's in the autumn of his life. All that, That sumbitch still wouldn't make the cover of a magazine.
No, no, you're
not
right.
Even close.
Not even close.
Like, why is that? Okay, I don't mean that socially, which is, let's explore it socially. It won't make the cover of the magazine because it doesn't meet sort of the national thing, sort of the national somewhat false notion of what a big buck is supposed to look like.
Correct.
That's a social aspect.
Yep.
But why is it that that deer can be 5.5 years old and be that big, but a deer from Buffalo County, Wisconsin, that's 5.5 years old, you're going to be able to fit that deer's antlers inside that Buffalo County deer's antlers?
So there's two high-level things going on there. One would be habitat nutrition, and one would be genetics. So this buck just doesn't have the genetics to develop into a gigantic deer. He just is what he is. Gigantic antler deer are very rare. I mean, even in places like Buffalo County, they're still relatively rare compared to average. So most mature bucks, probably even in the best places in the country, are still going to be, you know, a 5-6 year old buck with great habitat nutrition. Maybe would only be 140.
Really? So they don't all old bucks aren't huge bucks.
No, not all. It's always a bell curve, right? So there's always going to be that average. You know, most of your bucks maybe at 5 or 6 might be 140, 150.
Yeah. Remember when we were in Texas and the amount of like coal bucks that manager was shooting, that they were in that range. They were 140, 150 inch bucks. But he was shooting them for a couple of reasons. One, they weren't going to get big, but by taking them all out along with hundreds of does, he was leaving more habitat, more nutrition for, you know, those ones that they're really trying to let.
And an interesting thing that dude brought up is talk about the stress.
Right, just less competition with other deer.
He felt that this guy manages an extremely large property for some fairly wealthy individuals, and his mandate is to produce, to have this giant property more than 10 times the size of the property you're talking about, I believe. He's supposed to produce every year 2 gigantic bucks. That's his mandate, and he's a full-time manager on this place to create 2 gigantic bucks. In his efforts to create 2 gigantic bucks, once he identifies some candidates, they go in and start and systematically remove the competitors of those candidates to give those competitors less stress.
Yeah.
Because stress inhibits antler growth.
I would concur. I think that falls into habitat and or just herd dynamics.
So this buck feels like he's just lucky, but meanwhile he's just being watched and coddled. But you would think, until you talk to the guy, but then he talks about this, that even with all of that, there are bucks that vanish, and there are bucks that all of a sudden that you see him once and never see him again.
Yeah.
The mystery, like, there's still a tremendous amount of mystery. Much as he's like just actively doing this, if one day one shows up on a camera and you never see him again.
But, and that's some thick, thick country. I mean, you want to talk about Michigan being thick. I mean, this is the country that there's places where you just don't even go into it because it's so thorny and nasty.
Yeah, everything's like 12 feet high. Once you get up on a ladder, it's like, holy shit, you can see a long ways. But you get down on the ground, you can't see anything. But so the genetics deal, and then the nutrition.
Yeah. I think and then you made a good point.
Like good soil, poor soil.
Yeah, soil, and then what kind of available food sources and everything. So of course deer that live in agricultural country are going to have terrific amounts of food and protein and things they need to grow big antlers. And then soil does make a big difference too. So that's why you see such tremendous production of big antler deer along like the Mississippi River corridor and all that stuff going on there by you, Doug. So those types of things do lead to these genetic or these, I don't know if you want to call them freaks, but these huge antler deer that you're just not going to see as often in other places.
So I'm back on your deer again. So how big of a deer, how big of a body is this deer?
He's a tanker. Big old body. Just a huge girthy chest. His neck, like seamlessly goes right into his shoulders and chest. And when he walks around, he's got those curls on his neck.
Kind of turning me on, man.
Yeah.
Foot on the floor over there.
Yeah. And he's got the sagging belly. So, I love just a big-bodied, mature buck. I mean, and we're talking a lot about inches and antlers and stuff, and I just want to make sure antlers are cool, right? I mean, we enjoy big antler deer. They're neat to see. They're rare. They're special because, like we just talked about, large antler deer are not the average thing you're going to see. Yeah. So they're to be, in my opinion, they're to be appreciated and valued, and it's neat to hunt. But that's not all there is. Like, there's such an antler craze in the whitetail world. So many people are fixated on that.
Well, that's been around for
forever.
Forever.
But I just always want to be careful to make sure that even though I might talk about it in a conversation like that, that's not all there is. There's so much more to it. Like, so I'm glad you brought body size and different things like that, or history and experience of the deer, or yeah, a set of circumstances. I mean, all those things make that hunt, that deer, special.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you folks talk about trophy country and trophy hunts and that sort of stuff, and I think it's the same thing with whitetails. My favorite hunts are the ones that we've had these great stories about.
Yeah.
You know, a group of people hunting together. You know, we get this deer, or like your story where you watched him for a period of time, and you know, rather than, and he came out, I never saw him before, and I shot him. It's not much of a story, you know. It's not that it's not a great deer or anything like that, but I think the story really makes the,
yeah,
you know, and maybe the suffering or every, sort of like we just did, you know, we could have shot a caribou 100 yards from our camp,
right?
But we went out and went through a full experience. I mean, each one of us did,
yep,
some more than others.
But I don't think that I want to get back to like the scoring system and what people mean when they say 140 inches of antler.
Oh,
but yeah, I'll point out that is a good story. If all of a sudden a deer you didn't know about pops out, because the woods, there's supposed to be an element, not supposed to be, it's nice when there's an element of the unknown and an element of the surprise and an element of mystery.
Yeah.
I don't think it needs to be that in order for it to be legit, it needs to have like this agricultural overtone where you're like raising this deer up,
yeah,
and taking care of him.
I think there's lots of different ways it can be neat. I mean, like my experience I'm having with this deer, I think is unique and like super valuable, and I'm really enjoying it. But I think to your point too, showing up in a new place and seeing that deer for the first time, that moment when you first see this deer and the shock, like, oh my gosh, this is going to happen. Like, that can be really special too. But I think, you know, it's just different.
I like the surprise, you know. On our farm, I used to do a lot more trail camera, mm-hmm, stuff, and I still do a lot of it on client properties, but I haven't had trail cameras out at all this year. And, you know, very, very few, even at the end of the year last year on, yeah, our property, whereas I had them on other people's property because there, that's what I'm supposed to be doing on, mm-hmm, mine. It's sort of like, I don't know, kind of like that element of surprise, yeah, also.
You hear, know, about this popping up more and more in like the whitetail community, like that exact notion being that kind of just like some of us, we get overloaded on our cell phones. So like you need to purge it for a while and you just, you know, take off your Facebook app or whatever, so you're not on there all the time. It's just too much. I know a lot of people that feel the same way about trail cameras. They're, yeah, you know what? Lost the mystery of it. You know, every single, or know 90% of the deer that you're ever going to see. So I can totally understand. I enjoy using trail cameras, but at the same time, I do like the idea of that mystery, that surprise, that excitement. So I know guys that are starting to get rid of them.
Yeah. The trail, I like trail cams. Like, there's a few things I like about them. One, it just, you want to be becoming more educated, right? You like know more. You have more information. You know more about animals and how they move and how they interact with their environment. It's a valuable asset. Two, a lot of trail cam images have like a surreal beauty to them, that just like that, just the sort of the without the hand of man really there at the second, just like these like motion sensor activated images sometimes are just incredible. Like it clicks at a time when a person wouldn't click, and the result is sometimes like stunningly beautiful of animals in their environment completely unaware of any kind of intrusion. There's a beauty to it.
Absolutely.
Now, when earlier, Mark, I want to step back and talk about this. You're talking about 140 inches of antler. I think a lot of people don't really understand this. So what Mark's referring to is a number that comes from the Boone and Crockett Club. Now, the Boone and Crockett Club.
And or Pope and Young.
Let's talk about Boone and Crockett for a minute.
But Boone and Crockett originated it, right?
And the Boone and Crockett, started it. And they predate Pope and Young by 50 years
and
or
something. It's essentially the same measuring system. It's just one's bow, one's firearm.
Right.
In the late 1800s, early 1900s, when wildlife populations in America were collapsing and near collapse, and some of them gone, Theodore Roosevelt and other number of influential conservationist hunters started a group called the Boone and Crockett Club. And their initial mandate, their initial like reason for existence was to establish and push for the enforcement of game laws.
And Yellowstone was one of the first places.
So they had this idea that let's have it be that instead of the unregulated commercial slaughter of wildlife, we will establish bag limits and seasons and parameters under which people hunt. And that was how the Boone and Crockett Club, that was their initial thing. They were starting from the ground up. There was nothing in place. The system of scoring that eventually came out of this was a way to catalog animal populations. And at the time, you know, you didn't have genetic stuff. You didn't have sophisticated aging data. They didn't understand like tooth analysis and all this other kind of shit. A thing that's just very obvious is the antlers on the males, or in bears, just the general skull sizes. So they count a way to say, like, how can we objectively measure an animal's antlers in a way that is replicable, where any two individuals could look at it and apply the same metrics to it? And they came up with a scoring system. The thinking being that if you were to score these things and then track these populations over time, since antlers are a product of age and habitat, age and environment, you would be able to see long-term and short-term trends in antler growth and tell about the stability of a population. If you have a population, let's say you just, the other day we were in conversation talking about this. Let's say in Colorado you have that every year Colorado produces 10 bucks that score a 200 on this measuring system. 10 mule deer bucks score a 200 or better on this measuring system. And then you realize a decade goes by and not a single buck comes out of Colorado scoring a 200 on this measuring system. You would look and think something is amiss in Colorado. Something is not there that was there once. But now, in addition to that, people also, well, let me add another thing to this. Years ago, on an island where I have a hunting and fishing shack, years ago, a non-resident was allowed 2 bears on that island every year. Then it became like a bear, then it became that you have to draw a permit, and there's only about a 50% chance of being able to get a bear on the island. That was because they had noticed a very slight but gradual decline in the average bear skull coming off of that island, and that hinted to them to the idea of the potential for over-harvest, that the bears were shrinking, and they felt that they were probably shrinking due to selective harvest of large animals. So here's where that, like, that information, that metric ability influenced management policy. But people also just use it and talk about it in a very fluid way, being like a 140-inch buck. When you say that, that's what you're saying. And it's like a handful of measurements you take. You measure each, like you measure the main beam and all this other shit. And the scoring system is so pervasive that people don't even talk about tines anymore. They talk about G2s and all this shit. Because when you fill out the form, there's measurements like, what do the measurements look like? Yeah, and you know it by heart.
G1, 2, 3, 4. Those are your main tines.
Yeah.
And then you got your main beam lengths and your inside spread.
So some dude will be like, his G2, his right G2 is this. And that's just because when you fill out the form, that line of the form is for the G2.
Yeah. It was funny when we were looking at our caribou, I was like trying to refer to like a point. I didn't know, can I call this? Is this like the G16 on this one?
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't looked at how you score a caribou.
I don't know either.
But that's what Mark's getting at with the score thing. But a big, like, I think that when I was talking about in the national sense, like big, huge, giant whitetail bucks, aren't really guarded as big, huge bucks until they get to like have 180 inches of antler. That's like the, like with mule deer, it's like, if I could only kill a 200 inch buck. With elk, if I could only kill a 400 inch bull. With whitetails, it's what?
I think 170, because that's Boone, that's a Booner. Yeah. Boone and Crockett buck, it would make the Boone and Crockett record buck, record books. I mean, but again, it's all relative. Like a guy in New Hampshire, if he sees a 115 or 125 inch buck, he should be stoked. That's an amazing buck in that area. Or in Michigan, if you've got a, if so if you, 125 inch buck is a Pope and Young buck. Gross. Well, net, but, 125 inch buck in Michigan is like a pretty nice deer. 150 inches is a giant deer in Michigan. In Wisconsin, I'm sure 150 inch buck where you're at is like, ah, it's a nice buck, I would guess. But
oh, I don't know. 150 inch buck gets shot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's everybody will shoot that deer.
But I mean, I'm guessing like if that buck
but it's more
up,
common, right.
You pull up with that in the back of the pickup truck and people are like, oh, nice buck.
Yeah.
If you pull up with that buck at the buck pole on opening day gun season, there's 200 people swarmed around it taking pictures and looking at it.
Yeah. To what degree, because of your career, to what degree do you feel like you have to go shoot big bucks in order to like maintain your career? Would your career exist if you never shot a big buck?
So early on, I thought so. Like, I had this pressure, like the first few years when, you know, I was trying to build this website and this brand and everything. I thought like, I got to kill big bucks. And I stressed about it every year and stuff.
Or else you won't be able, you won't be a businessman. Right. You won't be a whitetail guy.
And I think now I don't worry about that nearly as much because I have not staked my reputation or what I'm doing on in any sense trying to claim like I'm the best deer hunter out there or I'm an expert on all that stuff. How I communicate and what I do, the service I think I provide is I am a just voracious learner. I love to learn. I want to consume as much as possible. I want to talk to as many different people as possible. So I'm trying to take in every different input I possibly can, and then I try to share what I learn, and then I share my experiences, lots of failures, lots of mistakes, occasional successes, and I share that real experience with my listeners, readers, etc. And I think that's much more relatable than the guy that kills a 180-inch buck every single year doing it one specific way. So now I don't necessarily worry. Of course, like, I need to have some credibility. You know, like, you'd like to see that the things I'm learning and trying and doing are, you know, paying off, and that, you know, okay, he tried X, he talked about X, resulted in Y.
Yeah,
so
that content is, I think, just more relevant to a larger,
yeah,
you know, group of the, you know, your listeners.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's where your credibility is, talking with you about whitetails. I really enjoyed the conversations, and it's your experiences and the stuff, the way you're looking at it all is the credibility is really there.
And I think, you know, the other thing I've done is that I'm not embarrassed to share like everything. And so I've shared all sorts of failures and mistakes I've made, and that's pretty rare within the whitetail world too. And so like someone at one point said like, oh, I just love your stuff. And he's like, and I think it's because you've cornered the market on failure. Like, you've done a great job of sharing all the mistakes you made. So, but you know what? We all make mistakes. We all fail sometimes. Just most people don't want to talk about it. And I'm okay putting it out there and hopefully getting better as we go along every
year.
Some
people have the idea that other people don't want to hear about the failures.
Mm-hmm. I probably get more feedback when I like, yeah, when something bad happens or I screw something up, like you, more emails and messages and stuff like, oh, that happened to me too, or I had this same issue, but I thought I was the only one, or I never like talked about how to deal with it, you know. And so we've worked through all sorts of different challenges that we all experience, but very rarely do you get to follow along with someone else on that experience.
And you could do everything right, especially with whitetails. You can do everything right, and for whatever reason, that deer turns and goes away. Oh, yeah. And all of that. And it's like, you sit there and go, well, what did I do wrong?
They are wild animals.
Yeah.
I think people who are trying to establish some notoriety or establish some claim in hunting in order to feed a career, like a media type career in hunting, you hear of so many examples, like there's a couple every year that come up of where they wind up crossing some pretty serious legal and ethical lines in order to achieve it.
For sure.
How much do you know the story about the guy we were talking about the other day from Michigan?
The guy from Michigan? Oh, Rampala?
Yeah. How well do you know it?
I couldn't give you all the details. I mean,
a sketch of it, though.
The super high-level story was back in the 90s, this guy killed this gigantic buck up in northern Michigan. It was just incredibly wide, like 30 inches wide or 26 inches
wide. In a place where
wide.
Bucks don't get big.
In place, yeah, in a place where you just would not see a buck like that. And it was, at the time, I don't remember if it was the biggest buck killed in the state at the time or they believed it was, but I got a lot of notoriety. I was telling you guys, I remember, I don't know how old I was 8 or 10 or something like that at the time, but I, even at that age, saw this picture in the newspaper and cut out the picture of this buck in the newspaper and put it up on my little board.
Everybody saw it. I remember, because my dad was a scorer. My dad scored for Pope and Young. He's like a certified scorer for Pope and Young, Boone and Crockett, MUCC, all that shit. So bucks flooded into our house to be scored. And I remember like just the buzz.
Yeah. It was
the Rampala buck,
yeah,
or whatever the hell it was called.
And it's an impressive looking deer. I mean, even still today, when you see the pictures, whoa. But eventually it came out that this was actually not a free ranging deer. This is possibly had been raised in a pen or different, you know, questionable activities had been involved with the killing of that deer. So it wasn't legit. It was proved, you know, wasn't able to enter it officially in record books, and he was kind of ostracized because of that, you know, for good reason. Some people still today say that he was actually a really good, legit hunter, and he'd killed many bucks in legitimate fashion. But for whatever reason, whether it be ego or a desire for notoriety or something, to your point, he crossed that line in a significant way.
And it's like, there are, I mean, we could, if we sat around, we could generate a list as long as your arm, man, of dozens of cases where that happens.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what is the, do you understand the pressure? Like, have you ever been like, man, Wired the Hunt would get a shot to the arm if I just could, or are you immune to it?
I'm immune to it because that's just like not me. Like, that's not my thing. But, like I said, I did feel that pressure. Like I should be killing like mature bucks. Like you need to have some kind of credibility.
Yeah.
But I've never been like the type that's trying like, oh, I have to kill a 180 inch or 190 inch buck or something. I'm not trying to be on the cover of a magazine or something with that. I just want to do something I love, share what I'm learning, and help people, hopefully. So I've never been in a position where I thought like that was going to skyrocket. I'm not doing TV or anything. But I know lots and lots of people that are. And I think it comes down to like your, like the why behind it. And so I think for some people, the why behind wanting a TV show or wanting whatever it is, because they want fame and fortune and attention and all that kind of stuff. My why has just been different. And so I just haven't worried about that.
What do you say? Do you ever give advice to people who wish they had a job in hunting or fishing or whatever? Like, you got to have people come and ask you.
Oh, hundreds and hundreds. Yeah. Lots of
people. Do you tell people? Is there an answer?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, a couple things. I can speak to like content related careers because that's what I do, like the media type stuff. So I would say number one, like figure out whatever medium or type of thing it is that you can do. Like either you have a natural skill set or experience in it or a passion for it. So are you going to write? Are you going to film? Are you going to photograph? Are you going to whatever it might be? Once you figure that out, and then number two, just do it. Like create stuff. Like get out there, have experiences, and put it out there. So for me, when I started a blog, a website, I had no reason that people should have been reading what I had to say. No one knew who this Mark Kenyon guy was, but I just created. So I was just constantly writing, constantly producing content. And so my advice is, number one, pick what you're passionate about and what you want to do. Number two, do it. Create it. And by doing it, you get better. Like you can fine-tune that craft the more you do it. But if you sit around thinking, well, someday I'm going to be a photographer, but I want to wait till I've got the $7,000 camera and I'm going to wait until this thing and that thing. No, you just got to get out there with what you have, do it, fine tune your craft, and then share it. And if you do that enough and you continue to grow and continue to get better, and by sharing that, I mean like whether it be through social media or networking in person, you establish relationships, connections. If you do all those things and if you get better at all those things, opportunities come about. So for me with my website, I just started writing when I decided I was going to do Wired to Hunt, I started the website, and then every single day without fail, I was working on it every single day. Like every day of the week, I had a new article. weekends I'd stay up, you know, late at night working on it. I work before the day job, I work on it after the day job, and I just was like, I'm gonna keep doing it. And then I share it on forums. I connected with everybody I possibly could on Facebook and Twitter and eventually Instagram. No any one of these single one things like was the reason why I was able to do what I'm doing now, but the relentless chipping away on all those different things, I think, led to it. So those are the three things that I recommend to most people. Very high level. It's not like some secret that I'm sharing. But that's what's worked for me. And then one other piece of advice, I guess, when it comes to content is find – you can't be a generalist when you're starting out is my thought. So if you want to be a – if you want to start a podcast or a website these days – if you start a general hunting podcast, it's hard to stand out because you can't necessarily create content that's perfect for the audience if you're just doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah.
The way I thought about things early on was I want to be very niche, because if I was very niche, I could say, okay, this is my audience. This is a very tight slice of people that are my audience. So it was super serious, passionate, relatively young people. And if I know who that audience is, if I'm very clear on who that audience is, it makes my work as a content creator very easy, because I know exactly what's going to resonate with that audience. So then because of that, I'm putting out stuff that just, oh man, that's exactly what I've always wanted to see, because I'm creating content for like one guy or girl versus trying to create everything for everybody. So once you can do that, then you have an ability to connect, grow from there. And so since I've been able to grow from there, now I can expand and do different things and generalize a touch, but I think that is a helpful process to go through early on.
That's interesting, man. That part. The other shit's all pretty obvious, but yeah. That's an interesting perspective on it. I don't know that I entirely agree with it, but I like it.
Fair enough.
First start writing about then? I mean, obviously it was whitetails, but when you were saying I'm trying to connect specifically with a small group of people, what was the...
So yeah, when I started the website, I was like 21. And, you know, I was, you know, at that point I was just switching to like trying to target mature bucks and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was writing about my own experiences at that point. I was writing about things I read. I was writing about, I was trying to interview different people and like people that were established, new stuff. I was trying to get them on the phone and pick their brains and share some of those experiences. I was doing gear reviews, just anything. I mean,
yeah.
Like we were talking about earlier, I was doing something whitetail related every day almost. So it's,
but the niche was whitetail. That's as niche as it got.
Sorry, let me clarify. So yes, the niche was whitetail, and it was the 365 days a year whitetail guy.
Uh-huh.
And then again, it was everything was with a little bit of an angle towards that younger generation. So the things that my generation was interested in, and then also the way I was communicating those things. So I was communicating with YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and, you know, whatever it might be at the time. And then also different technologies and stuff we talked a lot about. So apps that help out with deer hunting, or, you know, trail cameras or different things related to that. I mean, originally that wired to hunt idea in the very beginning was like the intersection of technology with hunting and all that. And it's kind of changed from there. But early on, those are the things I was tackling.
So what's the future of being a whitetail guy?
The future of being...
Let me ask you this. What are the, like, when you look at deer hunting, whitetail deer hunting, when you look into a crystal ball, what do you see?
For just the average deer hunter,
50
like our experience?
Years, whatever, like just some new number in the future. Do you imagine it, like, what kind of, you know, be recognizable? Do you think there's going to be like seismic changes? When I think about stuff, I'm like, I can't. It's just really hard for me to picture the future right now with the prospects of stuff like CWD.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think the last like decade or so, we've kind of been like the glory days of whitetail hunting in a lot of places. You know, herds have grown tremendously since the 60s and 70s. Most places, average age of bucks has been rising tremendously as more and more people are letting young bucks grow. They're paying attention to things like herd dynamics. They're trying to improve habitat, or, you know, think about conservation and kind of what they're doing. So all those things have been happening for a while. So we're in a generally good place.
Like reaping the benefits of those activities.
Generally reaping the benefits of those activities. So I think all those things, most people would recognize as a positive trend, I think. But to your point, there are concerning things like CWD, which is one of those deals that is such a long-term issue, like the impacts in the short term for most people right now, it's beyond like what they're looking at.
Yeah. When we say CWD, we're talking about chronic wasting disease. And we did a very exhaustive conversation with a CWD expert a few podcasts ago. So you can go find that if you want to catch up on what we're talking about. I don't want to recap it all now. Yeah. But yeah, so like a disease, wildlife disease issue.
Yeah. So the issue though with that, and why I think a lot of people struggle with like looking at it head on and wanting to do something about it, is because it doesn't necessarily have like population level impacts right now that you can see and feel, versus something like EHD, which is a virus, that in 1 year you can lose 60% of your deer herd. Mm-hmm. And that's something like, holy crap, all right, that you can feel that and like wrap your head around that. But with CWD, you might not necessarily see and feel that. But as I understand it, you know, over the course of decades, population level impacts do start showing up. So in Wyoming and Colorado, where CWD has been around for a long time, they are seeing that a significant proportion of bucks or deer in a herd are dying every year from CWD. So I think it's quite possible that 50 years from now, we will be seeing that in a lot of states.
When I ask that question, that's I like your perspective on it. But when I ask that question, when I look at it, what I'm seeing is the way the relationship people have with deer, the more social kind of spiritual relationship that people have with deer would change if it winds up that we begin to look at deer as disease vectors.
That would be a scary situation if that happened.
If it were to happen, like a thing that I really, the thing that I'm most afraid of, I'm not most afraid of like a disease like EHD, let's say it's going to come carry away 60 or 70% of your deer. I mean, that happens all the time. You recover from it. Like it's a pretty like a natural part of our system that happens. It's like you get these like too many deer, disease comes in, it wipes them out, they recover, you get back up and running in a few years, things go on. With chronic wasting disease, a thing I worry about, and thankfully it hasn't happened yet, would be that you'd have some cases where there's irrefutable proof that a person, that it would make the jump, and that a person would contract a fatal disease from consuming deer meat. Like just how that would shift public perceptions of the value of deer. And if there's a thing that you can learn, if you look at global, which is like global politics, global wildlife issues, wildlife thrives in places where it has a cultural value. If it does not have cultural value, it does not thrive. The reason we have wildlife in America and the abundance we do is because we've affixed a tremendous amount of cultural value. It is not here by mistake. And if it becomes that we look at deer with suspicion, I think it could really have like a really alter things. And like you being a whitetail guy and you talk about like pursuing whitetail guys and that's your audience, that's smart because 90% of big game hunters hunt whitetails. So we're talking about a major thing here, you know?
Huge.
So that's something that worries me a little bit.
For sure. I 100% agree. I hope that in the interim, in the next 20, 30, 40 years, whatever it might be, or whatever the timeline is, I hope we find some types of solutions because that is a grim situation to imagine if you're worried about if you can't eat deer anymore. Because not only does that impact us as hunters, but then also if you want to continue hunting. So let's say, okay, CWD is prevalent and we've all decided that there's possibilities of it transferring humans, so people aren't going to eat deer anymore, but hunters continue hunting them. From the outside looking in now one of the most understandable and relatable elements of why people hunt being looked at from the outside, all of a sudden that's gone. So now non-hunters look at what we're doing and saying, so you're just going to kill these deer and you're going to toss it out?
I wouldn't even waste my time with it. Same reason I don't waste my time shooting shitloads of carp and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like it just would cease to be of any – I'd hunt other stuff, but
– Yeah, I think you'd see it would be both an issue of what we're able to do and of like a credibility issue to the outside world.
Yeah.
It became another conversation that we had with – someone that I know in our area, their biggest, not their one and only concern, but their biggest interest in hunting deer is the antlers.
didn't have the same concern about CWD that I did, and it really, that's really upsetting to me because of that. Well, some of it's the public perception, but some of it's just it's a personal thing. I'm just like, what do you mean?
But what they don't realize is when they're looking at, when they say that all they care about is antlers, what they're looking at is they're not really thinking about where that value came from. They didn't create that value. They inherited that value. When they look at antlers, it's because those antlers represent something and stand for something.
Mm.
Right? A dude, if you had a dude from Mars come down and land on Earth, he wouldn't see a buck come out and be like, son of a bitch, them antlers are awesome. He just wouldn't. It's like they value it because they were brought up in a social context that puts a value on that. And the bigness, like the bigness of them is alluring to you because it's a rarity. Like plains, the equestrian plains, aboriginal bison hunters, like the Blackfeet, the Crow, they really valued a white buffalo. It was an anomaly. Right, it was like because you had to look at 10,000 to find one, and it had an extreme value. So when people say like, "I just like the antlers, dude," it's like, "Yeah, okay, you do because of how you, where you were brought up, how you were brought up, what the value system of it came in, because it was a rarity, because it was an achievement to have one get to be old, anyways. If you start to chip away at, if you start to chip away at like the legacy of deer, the broader cultural meanings of deer, you will see a diminishment in that interest." Like that interest is there's a tremendous foundation there that they might not be able to articulate and they might not know the history of, but it's like they didn't come out of a vacuum thinking big antlers are cool.
Yeah.
It's a learned thing. Little kids don't have it. They pick it up. So I think that if there are ways in which even that value over time would just cease to be that big of a deal. This is me being my most pessimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other way to look at it would be that, like, how shit generally kind of continues along, right? So, if I really had to like go and put money on it, I would say in 50 years, we're still going to be excited about deer hunting. We're still going to be excited about big bucks.
Yeah.
But when you sort of put on this like theoretical, what could possibly happen, it winds up being a little more entertaining to think about the dark side of things, and it just does the reality that my maternal grandfather liked to hunt deer. My paternal grandfather liked to hunt deer. My father liked to hunt deer. I like to hunt deer. My kid's already excited about hunting deer. I feel that there's like a pretty good momentum there that my kids will be all fired up about deer hunting. So I don't mean to sound like a big old naysayer.
Yeah.
No, I think as long as we as hunters do our part in making sure that's going to be possible in the future, making sure there's places to do it and healthy wildlife to pursue. I agree.
It's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah.
America will probably continue to be a really great country for a long time, but there's some shit I got my eye out for.
So, yeah, that's true.
There's a couple things I'm watching. So, yeah. Yanni, you got any thing you want to add in? Wedge in there in the end?
Man, I got a couple things I wanted to talk or ask Mark about or comment on. I feel like with the antlers and the inches, it's sort of like this. It's a little bit of a negative byproduct, right, of that scoring system that it's allowed some maybe like uber competitive people to sort of make hunting into a contest, and I really don't like that.
The golfification, how did you say that word? The golfification of hunting.
Yeah, where it's like, it's just not. It's just like this personal experience journey. Like you were explaining good the other day, where hunting to you is just sort of like this lifelong thing that you're involved in, you know? And, you know, I've mentioned this before. I have friends that have quit scoring animals because they realized how much it affected the way they felt about it. Like they would harvest this animal. It was a great trip. Everything was awesome about it. And they got home, put the tape on it, and it changed it somehow. And it's a bad byproduct, you know, like it started with, I think, such good intentions, you know, and I just want to be clear again to like the Martian or the outsider looking in when we talk about
Martian.
Yeah. When we talk about like seeing the 140 inch deer, yes, we're using that as another efficient way to talk about what we know is a great big buck.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, it's again, because it is that rarity and anomaly, it's like going to see a, you know, 500 foot waterfall somewhere, or seeing like the triple rainbow,
or a bearded lady.
Yeah.
I get an interesting example. Could be that.
Yeah, sure. But I 100% agree with you, honest.
Yeah, but it's just like, it's not a contest. And I feel like, yeah, we need to just, you know, monitor ourselves on that. And yeah, always remember that there's more to that. But my question to you, Mark, was you talked a lot about like picking your times to hunt, not hunting certain properties a lot.
Right. We talked about this the other day.
Yeah. And you mentioned it, I think, in the last hour as well, right? Like, you're just like real selective, you know, about when you're going to go hunt this buck. And it might only be 3 or 4 days in a season, mm-hmm. right? So does that limit your hunting to the point where, because I'm kind of like listening, I'm like, man, I'd want to get out and hunt more. Or do you have right. other properties where you're still getting, you're like, I'm not lacking hunting time because I'm sitting there waiting for the time to strike?
Yeah. So the way I do
Mark,
it.
Mark, can I interrupt real quick because I'm feeling awful about something? Yeah. You know, people used to pay to see bearded ladies in old circuses. It was a joke. I was making a joke about how people used to pay money in the old Barnum and Bailey days. Like, you'd pay money to go see a bearded lady.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I had heard of that.
Yeah.
I've not seen
the freak show.
It was like a part of the circus.
Yeah.
So anyways.
To your question.
Because I know that could potentially feel a little out of left field, right. but I was making an old circus joke.
It just didn't land. I don't know if it landed quite right. But so to Yanni's question. So yes, it would be the latter. So I try to have as many different places that I can hunt as possible so I can spread that hunting pressure across a number of different areas. So in this case with this buck, I know there's certain times of the year based on my analysis over the years that he's more vulnerable. So I'll be looking for certain factors such as temperature and wind direction, et cetera, et cetera. If those things look right, the first couple of days of the season, that's one of my best opportunities for a shot at him. So I'm going to hunt the first day or two of the season if the conditions are right. After that, I'm going to stay out because he just does not move in daylight on the property I can hunt from the first week of October through around like the 23rd, 24th. For whatever reason, he's a little bit more careful during that time frame. And lots of times what people have found and what I've seen too is that deer have relatively consistent annual patterns. So where you can see that a buck is going to be using a certain area, or he becomes more daylight active in a certain area year after year around the same general time frame. So this buck, around the 24th, 25th, 26th, he all of a sudden, a light switch for him in particular switches. So I had a shot at him on the 24th in 2015, and I had a shot at him on the 25th in 2016 in the exact same place. And I started picking up more trail camera pictures of him in the exact same place at that same time frame. So for that like 2.5 week period, I'll be hunting some public land. I'll be hunting in Ohio. I'll be hunting my family's little property up in northern Michigan. So yeah, I think in a perfect world, you'd like to have permission or public access to keep hunting a lot, but just any one particular place is going to have a smaller number of hunts. It's just picking the right times and then, you know, trying to have a concise kind of surgical strike when you go in there.
Yeah, but yeah. You're getting enough hunting days in to keep yourself happy because you know you're going to apply a certain amount of pressure, so you need places to apply that pressure.
So you just, in that case, you have to be willing to knock on a lot of doors or figure out how to hunt public land, or if you've got the funds to access land in some other way, do that. But yeah, we get that question a lot. Like, I want to hunt more. I wouldn't want to hunt this way. And you don't need to hunt that way at all. I mean, that's just, if you're hunting in a situation like I am where it's heavily pressured, and if you're targeting mature bucks, those types of tactics are most often the best way to go about it. But if you're just trying to, you know, shoot any deer to fill a freezer, go ahead and hunt your heart out. Because you can shoot does and yearling bucks doing that kind of thing.
I want to hit my concluders because it's a good place to wedge them in. One, when you're talking about the light switches and that buck starts coming out on October 23rd, that's kind of literal. Because that has a lot to do with like the photo period.
Photo period.
Length of day.
You're absolutely right.
I don't mean to present that as I'm telling you something you don't know. But it's just interesting. If people are just beginning to think about animals in a detailed way, it's so much of animal activity is really triggered by, if you see consistency, like to the calendar day, consistency with animals, what you're seeing is effects of changing day length.
Yeah.
which triggers many things. Yeah, change, like photo periods create windows of time. And then within those windows of time, there are many other factors that contribute. So that's a nice thing to keep your eye on when you start to really, when you really want to get detailed about learning about wildlife. But the thing, and you kind of touched on this a minute ago, but it struck me the other day as we were having this like age old argument where someone would be like, oh man, like the best time to hunt is when you can. And I was presenting that because I was talking about, we were talking about people who don't, who think that moon phase affects deer movements and they won't hunt if the moon's not right. And we were discussing a counter argument would be like, if you can be out in the woods, be out in the woods. And Mark was like, well, no, not really. And just reiterate again, why maybe not when you can be out in the woods, be out in the woods.
Yeah. So again, if you're trying to kill an old buck, these bucks are very savvy to human intrusion. So every time you go into a property, you increase the odds of that buck learning about your presence. So you're educating that buck and or the larger deer herd. Every time you step foot in there, whether it's to tinker with a tree stand or move a trail camera or to hunt, every time you go in there, you are educating deer. So you're
leaving scent, creating visual disturbance,
et cetera, et cetera. So your odds for success in the future decrease some percentage points every time you go in there. So my thought process is, if I'm trying to kill a mature buck, I want the odds of reward to be as high as possible because I know that there's going to be some level of risk every time. So I want to find the lowest risk and the highest reward days, strike on those days, minimize the number of intrusions so that I don't educate more deer, because you can educate that buck, or if you educate the doe herd and, you know, let's say in a situation where a mature doe or a handful of mature does starts picking up on the fact that I'm rolling into this little corner of the property every couple of days, then she doesn't come around anymore. Or when she comes in, she looks right at the tree stand. Mm-hmm. If that happens and the buck I'm after happens to be 100 yards behind and sees her spook, or maybe that buck would have followed her in towards a tree stand on November 1st, but because now those does know not to move in there during daylight, now he won't follow her in there. Always need to be thinking about the impacts of hunting pressure, human intrusion. And then, yeah, I mean, it's an odds thing. I'm constantly looking at the scale. Every single hunt I go into, I just have these two hands. And I look, okay, what are the things in favor of reward? So what do I have going for me? Maybe it's the time of year. Maybe it's the conditions. Maybe it's maybe I saw him in daylight recently moving. Maybe I know that a certain food source is going to be particularly palatable starting now. So those are all the things that will tell me how high or low that chance of reward will be. And then I'll look at the chances of risk. So what things could lead to me being, you know, spotted, or what could lead to me blowing my cover. So maybe it's wind. Maybe it's how many times I've been in there. Maybe it's the time of year. Maybe it's, you know, how the neighbors are hunting or doing something like that. So all those things factor into every single hunt, for me at least.
You know, you talked about whitetail guys will invent moves that kind of reminiscent of professional wrestling moves. Like you talk about like the bump and dump.
The bump and dump.
I would, if I was you, I would think of a move called the Kenyan.
So what's the Kenyan?
It would be that you sneak on to all the neighboring properties after dark and just make life hell for those deer. Thinking that they will naturally congregate on the property online where you have permission.
Oh, weren't we just talking about that whole deal with crossing the line?
The Kenyan. So every night you're just going through core feeding and bedding areas, just like raising holy hell.
Now here's, okay. This is the, that made me think
that is, I'm joking because Matt, that's what Mark does, and it is called the Kenyan.
That's definitely not what I do.
I'm joking. I'm totally joking.
But one thing I do is I kind of call it like my gun season sanctuary strategy.
Mm.
So I think about like if there's a property that I have sole access to. So again, this, if we keep referring to this 90 acres, this is like the one place I have that nobody else hunts. So I have the opportunity to do things there that otherwise, you know, if other guys were coming in and out, I wouldn't. So my thought process is that November 15th, as you know, in Michigan, the Orange Army comes out, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of deer hunters are in the woods. It's a dramatic increase in hunting pressure. Most of the deer in Michigan get killed during the first day of gun season and then over the course of the next couple of weeks. I choose not to hunt this property at all during gun season because my thoughts are that I create a sanctuary. It vacuums in deer from all the surrounding properties during that time period. So dozens and dozens of hunters are all around. They're all hunting with their guns. All these deer are looking for somewhere there's not hunters. That so happens to be this property. All these deer flood in there. This achieves two things for me. Number one, it pulls in deer in the short term. So if there is a mature buck that I'm after, it's more likely that he'll survive through gun season than I can continue to target him in the late season or into the future. And then number two, in the long term, a lot of year-and-a-half-old bucks come pouring in, or two-and-a-half-year-old bucks. Bucks I'd like to see make it to an older age class. I'd like to see a more balanced age structure. So I think I can have a disproportionate impact on the deer herd in a general area. Even though I'm only hunting a little piece of it, I can have a disproportionate impact because I create a safe place during the most dangerous time. More deer can make it through. And I can't quantify the impact that's had, but anecdotally, I do believe it has made a positive impact. I've seen mature bucks that I don't think would have made it if I was in there mucking around all the time.
Yeah, I would call that the crowdsourced canyon.
Do you monitor that property then during the gun season so that the guy next door, the guy on the other side, because a small property like that, dude just walks on the edge of a 40-acre, you know, it's only, you're only talking about something a quarter mile wide.
That's what we all joke about in Wisconsin. You wait till the Packers are playing and then go hunt the neighbor's land because you know damn sure he's not out in the woods.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's always that risk, right? But I've tried to establish positive relationships with the neighbors. So I'm trusting. Number two, I do have trail cameras all over the place that are monitoring edges and stuff. And I think I try to make that known. There's posted signs all around it that explicitly say that there are, you know, trail cameras monitoring this property.
Really?
Wow.
So that if you were to come on there, you know, there's a good risk that you're going to get spotted and prosecuted. So I try to manage that as best possible. And I try to be nearby as often as I can, too.
I go through that.
You got to make your presence known.
Yeah, I throttle a guy in the bar every once in a while.
Just in case he's been on your hand. Well, just walks in randomly, beats up a guy, and announces to everyone that he has a picture of him on his property.
I don't disbelieve that because today we walk into a restaurant and Doug's afraid to sit down with his back towards the group because he's worried someone might come up and clock him.
Yeah, he's got the gunfighter symbol. Doug, you got any concluders?
Yes, but one of them we would go on for a long time, skip that one. Well, but it is something I'd like to talk to you about in the future, and that is about how you gain access to properties.
Yeah.
Ooh, that would be good. I got a lot to say about
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I've got a lot to share on that.
And I want to do a whole episode called Permissions. Will you come back on for that?
Absolutely. I'd love to talk about it.
I think that's really you know, and of course, on my place, if you're a famous guy, you get to come and hunt.
You know, Fiddler on the Roof, that song, Traditions?
Yeah.
Traditions. We'll do Permissions.
Okay.
I never knew how much you guys sing either. That was something I learned on this trip.
Oh, dude, we sing a lot, man.
Especially when we all know the song.
Right? Oh, man.
So that's something for another time. I guess the other thing that I would say is that the most interesting part and enjoyable part of all this for me is, and I know why you two guys are getting along so well, and Yanni too, is that there's the passion that you have for what it is that you do. It's almost as if you came to this in both of your where you're making your living, because first you were passionate about hunting and animals and conservation and all of that, and then the rest of it followed. As opposed to I'm gonna be a TV guy, or I'm gonna be a podcast guy, or whatever, and so and then go, what am I gonna do it about?
Yeah.
And I just don't think that you can create that authenticity without that passion and sincerity. And I think that's really important and the thing that ties it all together.
I learned that in 10th grade from my teacher, Robert Heaton, who said what many writing teachers say and others should say is write what you know.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I mean, it's wonderful said, to be around.
Good, because I don't know about Shakespeare.
That
excuses me from that assignment. Yeah, I already did my concluder. You good on yours, Doug?
I'm good too,
man. That was a good one. I liked it.
Yeah, thanks.
And I do like your suggestion for the way ass bigger one.
Well, just
permissions.
You know. Yeah.
Mark, Concluders? You got your wedding ring off.
Yeah, I fiddled with this thing a
slowly. He lost his shoes. Now he lost his wedding ring. Hope your wife's not listening.
Yeah, watch out. We're laying in bed.
You're like a ring fiddler.
Oh, I'm a ring fiddler, big time. I've lost it in like car seat cushion or like, you know, down in the cracks and stuff many times.
I would be, but my fingers have changed. They've become more powerful to where I can't get mine off. I'll tell you a story though. You know, it's your turn for a concluder. When I was a kid, we were butchering a snapping turtle, and my old man somehow in the process lost his wedding ring. And my mother was devastated. He was all upset and searched and searched. And eventually he got to where he remembered that he had rinsed all the turtle meat in this big tub and then pulled the turtle meat out and then later took the tub and had dumped it in the garden just to like water. And went out and was looking around the garden and found the wedding ring.
Wow.
Where he dumped the, after like running it through in his head, like what could have possibly happened to that ring? It eventually occurred to him, and there it was in the garden.
How long was that time frame?
I don't remember. I was little.
We found a few in gut piles. We'd be back at camp, and the guy would, you know, all of a sudden go, oh no.
A few?
Yeah, twice it happened that I can remember.
So you go back and it's in the gut pile.
Yeah, we go back, and, you know, because it gets, that blood can be slick, you know, and if you don't have those, you know, ever powerful fingers that continue to grow, and, you know.
My father lost right his off. Delivering baby pigs.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Found it, the pig?
No, had never found it, but that's where
found he found it, some bacon years later. One time I was out, we were floating, fishing, and saw where a bunch of ravens were dicking around in the trees off the river. And we started going over there, and it's just bear trails, like new bear trails leading this area, and someone had butchered a moose.
Hmm.
And so it's an area the size of this hotel room. It's just matted down grass. You know, and they're just in there really heavy, like feeding on it. The carcass is totally gone. And laying in the middle of this room-sized piece of matted ground is a leather man that looks licked clean, just like glistening in the sun laying there. And you can tell that some dude like lost it butchering his moose. And eventually all the shit that was obscuring it from his view has been mopped up and then cleaned to the point where this thing looked like off the factory floor laying in there. I still have that thing.
Wow.
I still have it. That was over a decade ago.
Huh.
I keep it in kind of a special place. It's not in my medicine box, but it's in a place where it could someday make its way into it. It hasn't been upgraded to the medicine box, but it's close. Mark, your concluder. After a few delays there, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Well, I guess first I just want to thank you so much for having me here for this trip and this experience and being on here on the podcast. It's been an unbelievable experience. I think me and Doug have just said it over and over and over again to each other. Like, just look at each other and wow, just amazing.
So you're welcome.
So thank you. And I guess I was trying to think here about things we've talked about and things we haven't yet talked about. And something that is worth noting, and maybe it's more so, it's a kind of a whitetail guy thing, is that I'm generalizing here, but I think very often we whitetail guys get something that I kind of refer to as conservation tunnel vision, where we start looking at just our back 40 or our little place or our property, and we're very focused on just what's happening there. I just want to make sure, these are good things, maybe doing some habitat work or, you know, killing does because that's going to help your herd or whatever it might be. You care about that little slice, and that's important and good. But what I worry sometimes within my little community is that sometimes we fail to pay attention or care about the bigger picture things as much, like public land issues or clean air, or clean water, or whatever it might be. So one of the things I always try to remind my whitetail brotherhood is that all these bigger picture issues, they impact all of us too. So try to listen and hear about all these different issues, educate yourself, care about your back 40, but also look at these bigger picture things that impact your hunting rights or the ability for us to have, you know, vibrant wildlife populations across the country.
Yeah, like it or not, your back 40 is part of the earth.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, that's all I'd add too, is that we are a part of a very large connected world, and let's take care of it.
Have you ever heard the idea, it's a theoretical concept, that okay, like think of your own body, like you're an organism, right? And at being an organism, you're made up of many organs that have all these functions. So you have a circulatory system, right? You're like taking in liquids, pulling things, expelling things, and you're this part. And then you also have more cells that aren't you than that are you. When you think of all the microorganisms that comprise your gut and that live on you as parasites or in symbiotic relationships with yourself. There's this theoretical concept that you would think of the earth as an organism. And at first it seems kind of trippy and like a little bit out there. But once you start thinking about, if you imagine the earth as an organism and it has a circulatory system and it breathes and it has blood and it has microorganisms within it. It's just like something when you're like laying in bed at night. It's fun to start imagining that.
Yeah.
That you are one of those microbes, the same that you have millions and millions of microbes in you. You are one of those microbes that is part of this organism, the earth.
Yeah.
And your concept of your world, if you imagine if those microbes in your gut had consciousness, their consciousness would lead them to think that they are the thing. They are the thing that matters. And this body that gives them life and that they exist in is just this broader other that they don't really get because they are the point of existence. And expand that outward and outward and outward, and it becomes an interesting mental exercise.
Yeah, and I think if we all looked at things a little bit more that way, it could lead to some positive things.
All right, man. Thanks for tuning in.